Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward High School for Girls, where I talk to old Eds who left school and went on to pursue lots of different wonderful careers. My name is Ben Anderson and I'm a podcast producer, currently based in Liverpool, but obviously went to King Edward School, left school in 2006. Today, I'm joined by Neil Moxley, who left school in 1987. Neil, you've worked for the Daily Mail, you've worked for the Daily Star, currently chief sports reporter at the Sunday People. Thank you ever so much for coming on Ed Talks. It's really great to meet you.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me, Ben. It's very nice of you to indulge me.
I'm really looking forward to talking to you lots about Aston Villa today. I'm a Villa fan. And isn't it nice that the Villa are actually doing all right for once?
You didn't tell me that before we started, Ben, did you? Because I'm from the other side of the city. But no, it's great to see that Villa are doing well. It helps me out knowing professionally. And obviously, as I still live on the patch in the Midlands, you bump into lots and lots of Villa fans. So no, it's taking my personal allegiance to one side. It's fantastic to see the club doing so well, yeah.
Okay, well, before we start talking about your career then, because we were talking before we started recording, that there's two audiences really to this podcast. We've got old Eds who want to reconnect with school. You know, people, I look at the stats of where people are listening to this podcast, and it's literally people all over the world. Obviously, we all had the same start in Birmingham and Edgbaston, but people have spread out and gone all over the place now. So we've got an audience of old Eds who listen from the Boys and Girls School, but also current students as well. And I love producing this podcast with them in mind. The idea being that, you know, there is not one path to follow when you leave school. There's so many different careers that you can go into. And especially if you're at that stage where you're choosing your subjects, you're choosing your A-levels, you're thinking about university places. But Neil, let's take you back then to King Edward School in the 80s. What was Birmingham like then in the 1980s? Because you left in 87, so that must mean you started in 1980.
Yeah, we were Thatcher's children, really, weren't we? So I was a little bit fortunate. I passed my 11 plus. My father died, which meant that the family wasn't able to afford the fees. It was my mother was left with three kids. And Mrs. Thatcher implemented something called the City Assisted Places Scheme. And I was one of the first guinea pigs on that. And thankfully, the state, as it was at the time, made sure that if you passed the 11 plus, but family circumstances dictated that you couldn't actually take up your place, that they would step in and help with the fee. So, I'll be eternally grateful for that and for the benefits of it and for the platform that KES gave me, because it was a wonderful starting point in life, even though, you know, you don't understand it at the time. You don't really appreciate as a 10 or 11 year old kid just what an opportunity lies in front of you. But, you know, if I could go back in time, probably I would like to have made more of the opportunity. I tried to squeeze everything I could out of it, but perhaps now I probably would have tried to have slept in the school, you know, given all the opportunities for, you know, physical and mental improvement that there were on offer. Even back then, I mean, but Birmingham itself was obviously just coming out of the throes of recession. We just had the Handsworth riots, and it was trying to find its place in the world a little bit, really. After obviously the manufacturing successes of the 1960s, and obviously the problems with the unions in the 1970s, and it was a little bit of a desolate place when we're sort of like walking across town to get the 61, 2, and 3 bus down the old Bristol Road. But it turned into a completely different city by the time I left, and it was wonderful really to be part of that journey.
So what did you see change then in terms of that decade, starting right at the start of 1980? What did you see change with the city? Because I mean, you know, now I haven't been there for 5 years, and I go back in just 5 years, it's a completely different place. What did you see change?
I think it was that hope and aspiration. I think people, it was the time, you know, when towards the end of the, certainly towards the end of the decade, you know, there was a great big housing boom and a lot of things seemed to loosen up, and there seemed to be a lot more opportunities for people. I don't think that was the case really at the start of the decade. People were scrabbling around trying to look for things to do. And by the end of it, in terms of, certainly with respect to, you know, the council houses were freed up. I think Mrs. Thatcher enabled people to buy their own council houses, and people started to take a pride in home ownership, and house prices started to rocket. And basically there was a whole army of small, you know, tradesmen built up. And obviously the construction industry is a barometer even today is a barometer of so much. So I think that was the major the major difference. It was a period of hope, and it was a period of great change, really, as well. We come out of the, even if you look at things such as music, fashion, you know, you've come through the 70s, which was, you know, a period of flared trousers and all the rest of it, and groups like Slade, the glam rock era, and then you moved into the New Romantic. You've gone through punk, and then you moved into New Romantic. So, yeah, it was a time when, like I say, I think there was a lot of hope around the place, and there was plenty to look forward to.
Have you got any old photos that you look back on and have to keep at the bottom of the drawer, Neil, yeah, in terms
I've
of the haircuts
got,
at the time?
Yeah, and a few of them. So it's my brother sort of tells jokes with me. I look like David Garrett, which I don't know whether it's David Garrett feel mortally offended by that or whether I do, but that's about where I was, to be honest with you.
So the school itself, then, you say that, you know, there was loads of opportunities there. I think everybody looks back on it, don't they? You know, I didn't know how lucky I was at the age of 11 to end up at that school. I think we all could, you know, we'd all give ourselves a talking to if we could. But what did you do? What opportunities did you take up then when you joined the school outside of the academic side of things?
Oh, but to be honest with you, you know, it's mainly the two main sports. I presume that the school still excels in, you know, it's rugby and cricket. So, you know, I was playing football externally, and that was really my sport. You won't be surprised to learn, given the career path I've chosen since then. But yeah, I was quite small as a child. So, you know, and unsurprisingly, people who know me, you know, won't be surprised to learn that, you know, I was quite cheeky back in the day as well, which landed me in a bit of bother early on. I sort of like managed to get myself into the, you know, I was sort of like never really good enough to play for the first 15, whatever age group I was in rugby. But I managed to play cricket for the school all the way through up until I left. You know, one of the great things, you know, if people say what have your greatest sporting prowess? I did play football to a county standard, but I actually managed to play against Gary Lineker at cricket in the cricket week at the end of my final year and my penultimate year. Gary was playing cricket for the MCC to try and get his membership, because he lived in St John's Wood at the time in North London, and he turned out and was very much looking forward to seeing him play. But unfortunately, he was third in bat, and the opening two batsmen who were playing for the MCC that day were that good, we couldn't get him out. And he only came in for about two overs. So it wasn't really difficult. It wasn't really easy to see how good, bad, or indifferent he was. But So look, you know, it was all the sporting stuff. So I was playing a lot of football outside school, but inside school, you know, cricket and rugby were two things. But I was part of the cross country team, played fives for the house. You know, anything really that I could hit with a ball. Or play with it. I was just a bit, you know, if I'd gone back now, I'd have played tennis, because I've sort of latterly in my later years have discovered tennis. And I thoroughly enjoy that. But that, you know, in fairness, that was after going to Wimbledon for 15 years, you know, and watching the best tennis there is on the planet as a reporter. So, yeah, I mean, look, all those opportunities, played squash, didn't play basketball, but, you know, pretty much anything. You know, I mean, I was honestly knee high to a grasshopper. I was, you know, 4 or 5 stone ringing wet really when I went. So, yeah, look, you know, so many opportunities, so much sport to be played. To be honest, I wish I minute ago, I wish I had time again, because, you know, I'm sure there was a spare hour somewhere I could have gone and, you know, played squash again for an hour, or, you know, cricket in the indoor nets or anything. I loved it.
So what did you do for your A-levels, taking it away from the kind of extracurricular stuff and bringing it back to the academic side? When did writing become a thing for you? Did you know that you wanted to write about sport when you're at school, or did that come later on?
Well, my father was a journalist as well, so and his father before him, so it was sort of ingrained in me, really, as to what I'd grown up in that sort of era. I can still remember now, before my father died, you know, I could still hear him clattering out a copy on his old typewriter on a Sunday afternoon. You know, been to the pub for a couple of hours and was clattering away a copy, and then, you know, I was sort of thinking, well, that's a weird job, that is. Everybody else seems to work 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and my dad's out all day Saturday, and then he's spending Sunday afternoons, you know, on his time. What's all that about? You know, so you sort of grow up like that, and without realising, you sort of like via osmosis, you're sort of getting immersed in it, really. And, you know, I remember picking up my dad's contacts book one day and thumbing through it and seeing names like, you know, Terry Venables in there, because he used to produce the match day football programs. So, so he'd had all, he'd have like, you know, he'd have Ron Saunders, he's known with the old Villa manager, he'd have Terry, and I was thinking, oh, this is cool. Cause I was interested in football, from obviously from an early age. And basically I just started going to football then as well to watch games. But it wasn't really until I was thinking back ahead of this, you know, what we were doing today, cause I knew you were going to ask Ben. And I think I wrote something for the Chronicle. I reviewed a play for the Chronicle when I was about 15 or 16, and I'd been to see a play and it wasn't very good. And I had six paragraphs, and I just basically coated everybody in it. I said it was a poor production. I didn't think any of the actors were any good. Woe betide anybody who had the misfortune to go and see it. Anyway, probably as a portent of things to come, Giles Evans, who was, bless him, I think the late Giles Evans, who was my English teacher at the time, came marching down the corridor with the words, Moxley, or I want a word with you, which isn't the first time or isn't the last time those comments have been made in my direction. And basically had me up against the wall, brandishing a copy of the Chronicle saying, what's this? And I said, well, it was an honest précis of what went on. And he went, you know nothing. And that's not an unfamiliar phrase in my direct that's been pointed in my direction. And went off very much in a huff. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, my words have had a real, you know, real bearing on what somebody thought there. You know, so perhaps it awakened something in me because, you know, I was still playing ridiculous amounts of football at the time. And I passed my O-levels. I got all 11 O-levels, got all 10 O-levels. But my family circumstances had changed, Ben. My mother, despite the fact my dad was died from basically alcoholism, which is sort of like a bit of an occupational hazard for journalists of that era, had remarried a publican. And so I sort of had a strange existence where I'd be going to this wonderful independent school by day. And yet by night, I was sort of coming home and brushing shoulders with, you know, very working class people in, you know, in Yardley, an area, you know, pretty much working blue collar area of Birmingham. But looking back, it was just wonderful. Tossing the fact I was playing like football, you know, up to county 11, I was playing in men's teams from the age of 15. So I was half decent, and I didn't really pay any attention to my A levels. And I don't really think, looking back now, I was mature enough to cope with what was being asked of me in terms of I didn't really get what the A level system was about. I didn't realise how analytic it was, how you'd have to do extra reading to formulate opinions on stuff. I took history, English, French, general studies, obviously, as everybody did. And really, truthfully speaking, I should have taken economics, history and Latin. But, you know, because those subjects seemed to appeal more to me. But that was my fault. It wasn't the fault of the schools. And I wasn't really paying enough attention. I got my A-level grades, but I was going to go to Sheffield to read law. And I ended up at Wolverhampton Polytechnic, as it was, doing business studies.
So when did it, what was the first job? Because you have got the dream job for so many people, I imagine, listening to this. You know, you are writing about the sport that you love every week. I mean, obviously, you know, I know that you cover all sorts of different sports in your role, but football predominantly. What was the first step towards that? Because it's the dream job, isn't it?
Well, you know, I suddenly thought to myself when I started, you know, how isn't everybody doing this? Why doesn't everybody want to do it? And then I sort of realised there's a few reasons. You know, it's extremely unsocial hours, and it's a lifestyle choice. If anybody out there, I hope my words today, if somebody's considering a career in journalism, I hope I can light a bit of a fire under them if I can. But I would just caveat that by saying it is a lifestyle choice. You know, if you've come into this job thinking that you're going to be home at 5:30 every night, you can forget it. It's just not going to happen. You know, I can't count the number of times I've driven back late at night from, you know, all sorts of places in the UK to get back home at 1:30, 2:00, 2:30 in the morning, travelled overnight from European games, mainly covering Wales for the Daily Mail. And sort of getting back to Cardiff and everybody else going to bed and me thinking, oh, I've got a 2.5-hour drive home now. you know, to get back to where I live. And, you know, when you're coming back from, you know, far-flung places in Croatia and at that sort of time where there's you're flying back from military air bases and stuff like that, it's I wouldn't say it's glamorous exactly. It's just a tale to tell. But it, like I say, it's not a routine job. So that was the first thing. I sort of thought to myself when I started, you know, this is great, you know, but as it was, it turned out, you know, it really is a lifestyle choice. I'll tell you the time when I sort of fell in love with it. I got my first job. I went to Wolverhampton Polytechnic, got in business studies, did a sandwich course. Fantastic. Not a problem. And then I came out and I got a job for a management consultancy, and I went to watch England play football as a fan in Poznan in Poland. And me and a pal of mine, we'd flown into Prague just after the war had come down. I think it was 1992, November 92. And we'd had a horrible journey to get there. We spent 3 days in Prague, and then we got an overnight train from Prague to Poznan, and we had to change at a place called Rocklaw at 5 a.m. And there was all sorts of people sleeping in the subway, and you know, and you just made you realise how lucky you were. And then we got to the game. I didn't have a hotel booked. I'm forever grateful for a couple of Villa fans who put me up on the hotel floor that night. And basically, it threw it down with rain all day. And then I was standing there looking outside the ground, and there was a busload of blokes got out, mainly men, it has to be said. And I thought, well, they all look well kitted out. They've got the briefcases with them. They've got the rain mats on. They've basically been transported to the front door. No doubt they were going back to 4 or 5 star hotels that night. I thought, that's the press. That's the press. Anyway, I basically went home, resigned from my job, got on a postgraduate course because my grandfather had been president of the NUJ for no other reason than that, because some of the lecturers there sort of saw that on the application form and must have been seduced by it, because I didn't have any journalistic experience, so to speak, of.
And that's the National Union. That's correct.
Yeah, that's the NUJ. My grandfather was president of it. Or at least I think he was during the Second World War. One of the years in the Second World War. So unfortunately, I got on this course, and within 5 months, I basically was doing a day release, a small paper in Solihull called the Solihull Times, and an opportunity came up to start out, and I did my news training. And I remember distinctly when I thought, I'm going to like this. We used to have to do film reviews, and we used to get like free passes to go and see every film, you know, every film. And I remember going to the cinema in Solihull, and it was just at the start of the Lethal Weapon series of films. And it was 9:30 in the morning, and I'm sat there with a cup of coffee watching Mel Gibson. And I'm thinking, I'm getting paid for this. This is just ace. And it wasn't a lot of money. I didn't do it for the money. But, you know, while everybody else was going out and, you know, doing whatever they were doing, I was sitting drinking coffee in the cinema until lunchtime. So, and then I'd go back and have to write 400 words on it. And obviously preview the play, and people had read it in the back. And that was my day. It was just wonderful. I loved it. All I wanted to do was sport. So I put up with this minor inconvenience, watching films. And doing a bit of news reporting, and going to court and all that, and council meetings. That was good. It was great. It was a great grounding, really. And I'm pleased I did it that way. But yeah, that's basically how I got into it.
You know, it's really interesting what you say about how it's a lifestyle. I've got a mate who I met, well, I first met him when he was a radio salesman at a radio station I ran over in North Wales. And we got mates because he was like, you know, what are you guys doing in the programming team? That looks really fun. I want to do some of that. Long story short, his passion was sport, and he's now working his way up in the commentary world. So he commentates on Bundesliga for TalkSport. He's recently got his first BBC shift. He's covering Blackpool a few weeks back. And I called him up after, like, mate, how was it? Expecting him to be buzzing. And he was. He was over the moon that he'd just done this. But he went, it's so cold. I am so tired, and it is so cold in Blackpool. And, you know, it's a job, isn't it? You know, it's you've got to love it sometimes. Has it ever felt like a job for you? Because I know that before we started recording again, you said that you still love it to this day.
I'm a little bit like Gareth Southgate, the England manager. You know, he sort of said, I love the sport. I don't like the industry. And I sort of get that. you know, I mean, you know, there's a lot of money coming to it, and there's a lot of nefarious individuals, really. And but yeah, has it ever felt like a job? Yeah, on occasions. Yeah, it has. I mean, it's, you know, it's hard. It's tough. You know, I mean, tough. You know, it's, you know, if you're getting up at 9, you know, I work for a Sunday newspaper now, and you know, towards the end of the week when everybody else is winding down, you're just gearing up. You know, and my Thursday last week started at 7 o'clock in the morning when I went to interview a racehorse trainer, and finished at late in Wolverhampton. So I'd been to Wiltshire and I'd been up to Wolverhampton, and I got home gone midnight, and then Friday was a trip over to Leicester to see Brendan Rodgers, and then Saturday was another trip, quite a lengthy trip. Where did I go? I can't remember now, but wherever it was, oh, it was Brentford. I went to Brentford, so you know, West London. So you know, they end up, it's a lot of travelling. It's a lot of long days, but you know, if you love what you do, you make those sacrifices, don't you? But yeah, I mean, it's not a walk in the park, but it's you know, you end up with some great life experiences, and you know, I'd like to think I'm a decent dinner party guest.
People always say, don't you, you know, do a job that you love and you don't work a day in your life. I struggle with that a little bit, and especially when I'm talking to younger people about what they should do and what they want to do with their lives, because I loved radio. I didn't go to university to study radio. I went to study something completely different and fell in love with the student radio station when I was there. And that led to my first job, 21, producing a breakfast show and spending 10 years in UK radio. Going to be honest, by the end of it, I didn't listen to the radio. I listened to the radio I had to listen to because it was my job and they were my stations, and they had to, you know, had to listen to them to work out what could we do more of, what should we do less of, all that kind of analytical stuff. But I didn't listen to other radio stations. You know, I couldn't. I was almost sick of radio by the time I come to the end of it. And luckily, podcasts for me have completely... I love audio. You know, I love telling stories and I love meeting people. And I love interviewing people. And podcasts have given me that opportunity to kind of give me that spark back again. Obviously, what you're saying, you love football and you love sport and you played sport for years. You know, what do you think about that? Should people do something that they love? Or is it tricky ground? Because, you know, like my story, you could end up not enjoying it as much anymore.
Yeah, I think they should. I think they should try and follow their passion, whatever they're passionate about, really. That would be my... it just have to be love so much as passion, really. I think I wrote a good red top match report after I went to Brentford versus Burnley. I think I wrote the best I could. I think it was, you know, it ticked a lot of, you know, I thought it was okay. You know, and I still get a, you know, sometimes I come away and I think, oh, it was a struggle, you know, or I've not written that well, or, but you still get a buzz of seeing, you know, I know it's old fashioned now, but you still get a buzz of seeing your name sort of on back pages of newspapers. And, you know, I still get a buzz from, you know, getting a good story, you know, nobody else has got, or, you know, just upsetting the apple cart every now and again. And, Just, yeah, I do. I love journalism. I love footballs. And I think, do you know what, Ben? I think you've got, if you're brutally honest, if you can do this to yourself in your early 20s, possibly, or even before that, and work out what you're passionate about, and more importantly, whether your skill set as a human being basically marries up with that. I actually happen to think that, listen, I'm not blowing my own trumpet. There's better journalists out there, there's better sports reports and all the rest of it. But clearly, to be in it for 30-odd years, I've been okay at it. I actually genuinely think, looking back now, my personality, it suited my personality and my skill set. You know, I was never one for... I never did well at the science. I was okay at science. You know, I could get by. I passed my exam. But I wasn't really that... That wasn't my bent. My bent's really always been around people. And to be honest with you, that's I know it's another skill, but, you know, you have to... You know, be able to converse with, but one of the great things King Edwards has given me the self-confidence to walk into a room and know, and absolutely know, that there's nobody else or anybody, there's very few other people in there who've got had a better platform and education than me. It doesn't matter what other school they've been to in the country. Some of the top fee-paying schools in the country, King Edwards is on a par with them. And that's what it's given me. It's given me the self-confidence to know that if I want to talk about, you know, depreciation and amortisation of footballers with chief executives of football clubs, I can do it. If I want to talk about, you know, the ball retention with people in first team coaches at football clubs. I can do it. If I have to talk, you know, on the level with young footballers, then, you know, I'll try to take them into places where I know it's going to make entertaining and engaging copy. That's what it's done for me. It's given me the self-confidence to sort of to work at different levels and to be comfortable, you know, and have that sort of knowledge that, listen, you're an equal of anybody else in this room. So, you know, don't ever be cowed by them. And that, I think that's an important quality for journalists. And I think it's an important quality for anybody who might be listening to this, who's deciding upon their career path. You know, if you can marry up your skill sets to your passion, I think you're halfway home. You might have a care and interest in animals, and, you know, have a particular bent towards science. Well, you know, you're going to become a vet, aren't you? You know, it's just, you know, it's, I think it's, you know, listen, I think I've been fortunate, so lucky really, but, you know, without the grounding that King Edwards has given me, I don't think I'd be as confident as I have been.
Hi, I'm Sana.
And I'm Betty, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places Scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places Scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
Neil, I'd love to talk to you about change now, and change within football and within journalism, because you've been, you know, I said 30 plus years doing this now. I mean, when you were saying earlier about Gary Lineker playing cricket, you wouldn't necessarily see a young footballer today putting their pads on and going out and playing cricket if they're part of the academy. Like, how's football changed in the time that you've been doing this job? And how's it, both for good and bad?
Yeah, I think, I'll take you back to my days when I started off. I sort of got my break at the Solihull Times. Then I went and worked for three newspapers in the Black Country, and as a sports editor, which was fabulous, covering Owlsham in Town, Stourbridge and Dudley Town. And what it did was it enabled me to get the ground rules, basically, what you can and can't ask football managers, what you should and shouldn't ask football club chairman, what you should and shouldn't ask footballers and managers. So, you know, anybody who just gets catapulted in is doing themselves a disservice, because I didn't learn everything, but it gave me a good idea of what was to come. The reason I mention this is because my next sort of calling, I went to the Sunday Mercury, which, as people in Birmingham will know, is a regional newspaper, Sunday regional newspaper. And then I went to cover your club, Aston Villa, on the Birmingham Evening Mail. And I remember when I was on the Birmingham Evening Mail, there was a guy produced a book about the only footballer that was ever murdered, a guy called Ball. I think his name was Albert Ball. Anyway, effectively, he produced this book. I think he remains the only first division footballer ever to have been murdered, while out and about. And effectively, it was a noisy neighbour dispute. The guy, the footballer had got some dogs. His next door neighbour was a retired ex-army guy who'd been through the First World War, got a few, sounded like he got PTSD, and effectively, but one night, shot the bloke and shot his two dogs. And the reason I mention this is because it was mentioned in court that the footballer earns four times what the police, the retired police sergeant did. And I think that multiple in terms of earnings lasted pretty much until the start of the Premier League, which coincided with my start of my career. And what happened after that is it's just ballooned beyond all recognition. No longer do footballers sort of stand, you know, occupy the same sort of space in society as they once did. You know, they could walk into, you know, boozers and have a drink with people and brush shoulders with them, and nobody think really much. You know, they'd look at them and think, yeah, they're doing well for themselves. You'd look at them and think, there's a first division footballer, but they wouldn't think there's somebody who's now on a level with pop stars and treated like, you know, social royalty as they are now. And that's really been a change. And it's a bit of a shame, really. They've done away, a lot of football clubs have done away with things like, you know, the apprentice schemes. So in the past, like, you know, the kids would have to sweep out changing rooms, they'd have to clean first teamers' boots, they'd have to, you know, mop up the canteen, clear people's plate. That's some, I, when I was speaking to Kevin Ratcliffe, who won the title with Everton, he was saying to me that, you know, when he started at Everton, if he wanted to go into the first team changing room, he had to knock the door and ask permission. Well, that's just, all that discipline's just disappeared right out the window now. It just doesn't, you know, just there's two, you know, the boot's on the other foot. A lot of footballers, the top ones, have got so much power that they can pretty much call the shots, because the football club's success or failure depends on the performance of these players. There's a correlation, and the football clubs want to keep them happy. So they bend over backwards for them and then rely upon them on the pitch to produce what they're being paid for. Sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't. And it's, in certain respects, you know, it's a little bit sad, but in other respects, it's been wonderful to sort of be a part of, because, you know, working conditions have improved. Everybody's, you know, the spotlight on football, people that cover football has rocketed beyond all recognition, really. When I was sort of growing up in the 80s, if you want to go back there, it was pretty much, it really was going through a bit of a death spiral, you know, crumbling stadia, falling crowds, lack of interest, hooliganism, all these sort of issues. And then basically somebody decided that there was interest in it after all that needed to be tapped. And the Premier League was born. And since then, it's been a pretty much boom time. Although, you know, in fairness at the moment, the sport is at a bit of a crossroads.
It's interesting listening about the kind of the power of the player, because, of course, you know, the owners these days have got a huge amount of sway. I mean, when you first started doing this job, could you have imagined that something like the European Super League would have even been suggested?
No, probably not, because I personally couldn't see any reason why they'd get rid of the Champions League. I mean, there has been, you know, sort of research done on what value football fans place on their domestic competition, i.e. the Premier League, and what they place on, you know, sort of European competition. And time after time, the answer comes back is they see more value as a Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea, Villa, whoever fan, in winning their own national league than they do, you know, there's more interest in winning the European competition. That's not to say that, you know, Villa wouldn't like to be European champions again. Of course they would, but, you know, I think they'd much rather, but this is just me talking, I think there's, you know, I think people would much rather actually win the league and be able to walk around, you know, the country sort of saying we're the champions of England. And then obviously if you end up being the champions of Europe, fantastic, but it's still a huge amount. And for that reason, I think that, you know, English football, as I wouldn't say shot itself in the foot, but it's just, you know, it's, well, yeah, I think they have shot themselves in the foot a little bit, because I didn't see anything too wrong with the current system. That's where I'm with that, to be honest with you. It has changed, not for the better, but in terms of like going to see people, you know, I've had some wonderful experience. When I was covering the Villa, you know, I'd every now and again, Doug Ellis would invite you around for supper at his house, just to let you know you're on point with the messages that he wanted out, you know, and you know, he sort of, obviously you had to sit there and, you know, I remember going to a surreal experience. I was sitting there in Doug's front room, and he's watching Manchester United versus Juventus, with him telling me that he then taught the chairman of the day, Martin Edwards, Manchester United chairman of the day, Martin Edwards, everything he knew. And, you know, and basically sipping beer out of one of Doug's, Aston Manor Brewery that Doug used to own, having chicken chasseur on his couch. And I was thinking, is this happening to me? I was about 26, 27 at the time, but it was a really surreal experience. And despite what people think, Doug Ellis was a thoroughly decent human being.
And one of the last of his kind, really, when you look
I referred to him, you know, until the last time I saw him as chairman, and I hold a lot of deep affection for Doug for what he did for Villa. He was, he could be a bit conceited and all the rest of it, but he was a smooth operator. He was good for that. He was good for that football club, and I liked him a lot.
Yeah, and to be fair, the Midlands have got a few good examples of that. You know, Sir Jack over at Wolves as well. You know, very similar man. Did he sell the club for a quid, Sir Jack, at one point, didn't he, to keep it?
Yeah, he sold it to Steve Morgan, who basically came and said and guaranteed the fact he would spend £30 million in the transfer market on the basis that Sir Jack sold the club to him for a pound. You know, I think his investment in Wolves was over £70 million, and, you know, what more can you say for a guy that grew up within earshot of Molineux who made it good to stump up that kind of cash, really. He was good fun for a while following Wolves. particularly when Graham Taylor was there as manager. So yeah, I mean, it was, we've had some good characters around here. We've had Karen Brady and David Sullivan and David Gold at Birmingham. That's an interesting. I've got more trouble. Probably got. I won't get into trouble, Ben, because you'll get sued. But we've had some fun with them over the years. Had some interesting moments.
Do you think we're ever going to lose those characters with the way it's all going? I mean, just thinking about, for example, the owners now are, you know, they're not the Doug Ellis's anymore who invest their lives in these clubs. They're people who invest, well, Chelsea's, the price tag on Chelsea, was it $2.5 billion that's been suggested by Saudi Media Group? You know, it's crazy money. In 30 years, is it just going to keep on changing and changing and changing? Or can this bubble not get any bigger without bursting, in terms of the money, in terms of the fame? Are we at kind of saturation point with all that kind of stuff? And are we going to get back to it being a lot more about the football soon?
I don't think so, Ben, if the truth be told. You know, I don't think I think somebody said there was like 20 interested parties in buying Chelsea. You know, I mean, if they're willing to stump up the sort of cash you've been talking about, £2.5 billion upwards, then clearly, you know, they're not going to put that kind of cash on the table if they don't see a future, you know, return on that investment some time to come. I don't think we are. I mean, the overseas broadcast rights to the Premier League have shot up, I think I'm right in saying, fivefold. So in terms of, you know, overseas interest in the product, you know, it's very much still there. You know, and we expected the last time, you know, in the industry expected that the last time that domestic TV rights came up, one of the big streaming services might come in, a Netflix, a Disney, you know, one of those guys, because we thought that now there's the power to, you don't have to put it on a platform such as Sky. You can actually stream it directly to people, and they can pay, you know, they can pay for what they want, you know, in terms of, you know, it might be $5 to watch Manchester United play, or it might be, you know, however many Hong Kong dollars to watch Liverpool play. So in that respect, if they've built it up into a global brand, really what they want to do is take advantage of that interest, all that interest out in the Far East, especially that the bigger clubs have got, you know, and monetize it. So we, you know, in terms of, as long as they can protect the brand, I still think there's some mileage in it yet, mainly because I think when it does, when people, the market is mature enough to withstand this, you know, and come get to grips with streaming, however they do it, then that's the next logical step for me. They'll take it off its current platform, and, you know, you may well see interest spike even more, but, whether or not that happening, it certainly won't happen for the next few years because I think Sky have got it tied up, but that's the way I think it will go.
Neil, I've absolutely loved speaking to you today. And, it's great because obviously, you know, it's your interest in the sport itself that took you into this career. But there's obviously so much other stuff around it that just, it's great to hear about. And so you don't think about it when you think, you know, you're sitting there with Doug Ellis having a, what was it, chicken?
Chicken satsuma, I think it was. I can't remember. It was a few years ago now, Ben, to be fair. But, you know, I've had some wonderful, you know, there's people out there who've made more money. There's people out there who've spent less time working. There's people out there who've achieved more than I will, but and ever will. But I'll tell you what, in terms of, you know, if you want a fun, varied, interesting, challenging, and strange, sometimes strangely personally rewarding career, then get into journalism, because you never know from one day to the next what you're going to be covering, and the only constant in life is change. So you roll with the punches, you go with the flow, and see where it takes you. But to be honest, Ben, you know, I've had a great time, and you know, a lot of it's down to the reason I'm speaking to you is because, you know, I feel a debt to the school. You know, I feel like, I, you know, if I can, my words can inspire somebody else to follow the same path as I have, and have, you know, and do what, and have as much fun as I have, then that's been worthwhile. But like I say, the school means everything to me, and I'm really privileged that you've asked me a few questions.
Well, there's one final one that I ask everybody, and that is, I think I might know what your answer is to this from something you said earlier on, but if you could if you could highlight one characteristic or choose one characteristic that you think has served you best in your career since leaving school, what would that be?
Yeah, it would be, I'd return you to the, you know, the conversation of, you know, half an hour ago when I sort of talked about the fact that, you know, when you've been to KES, it gives you the self, it should give everybody who went there the self-confidence to know that you've had a top quality grounding in life, that whatever you do, you know, whether you go to, off to Oxbridge, and I hope, but it's still sending, you know, sending people to Oxbridge regularly, that, you know, you've had a fantastic start. You know, I wouldn't change it for the world. And I wish I could relive those times again, because it really was just a wonderful 7 years.
Neil Moxley, Chief Sports Reporter at the Sunday People. Thanks so much for your time on Ed Talks. It's been great to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk.